Hello and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, Nicky Radio in Hertfordshire, and to our listeners in Swindon, hello Swindon FM. Hello to our listeners in Cirencester, Queen of the Cotswolds. I'm James Amelia.
And I'm Poppy Searchfield.
Coming up in the show.
You see a chair, and I've seen one which was, for instance, on the Antiques Roadshow many years ago, and I looked at it and I said, well, it wasn't by the Royal Maker. It was by another renowned maker. It wasn't a beginner, because you could see the way it had been finished. It had also been cut down. But it took me 10 years to find another one, which turned out to be in a secondary school in East Sussex.
We hear more from Stephen Lough-Simpson on the history of the sedan chair. Stephen is the world expert. Our first guest is Dinah Mason.
Hello, Dinah. You're here today to talk a little bit to us about art therapy. Perhaps you could just start by explaining exactly what that is.
Yeah. Well, I've always been interested in art. I did my first degree in art, and I've always also been interested in the way people work out their difficulties and the good stuff and the bad stuff, actually, in terms of making marks and portraying themselves and their lives. So art therapy is a way of helping people who are experiencing actually quite very big difficulties in their lives, maybe have suffering trauma or have suffered great loss or something. It's basically a way of creating a safe therapeutic space for people to explore their difficulties and their feelings and express them. It's good for people who find it really hard to just use verbal communication. So they're finding it hard to maybe find the words, and using art materials as well as verbal communication is a good way to kind of explore stuff that's hard for them to get at. But it's also really good for people who talk and talk and talk and never actually say anything. So, you know, you sometimes meet people who use words as a sort of wall of protection. Good for people who don't normally do any art at all. You know, you don't have to be an artist to do art therapy.
In your experience, is it quite an effective technique?
Yeah, it's working in partnership, so the person you're working with has to be wanting to do the work. And so I might now work with a variety of age groups as well. So at the moment I'm working with children and families. I do a lot of work with adoption and looked after children. But I have also in the past worked with adults with learning difficulties, adults with eating disorders, older adults. I think my oldest client was 90-something. So a wide range of things and people and different situations, really.
And is it all types of art that you could use?
Obviously paint and clay, collage, anything really, sculpture, junk modelling, mask work. I do quite a lot of mask work and puppetry as well. So people making puppets and then using them to act out their story.
I suppose it depends which works best for the individual patient, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that's good to meet the person where they are and find out what they want to use and what kind of works for them, really. Mm. And different materials will be good for different things. So for someone who's quite traumatised, paint can be quite scary because it flows and is quite difficult to control, whereas clay is something which stays put. It's got edges that don't move once you finish putting them where you want them. It's more kind of solid and sturdy, so that's quite good for people who are quite scared, really.
Sure. So I understand you took these techniques over to Bhopal in India, where obviously there was a terrible chemical accident about 20-25 years ago now. You know, how did you start to apply these techniques over there?
Well, I went with a group project. We were invited by the Bhopal Medical Appeal, and it's a charity I used to work with years ago with community arts and education called Children's World, based in Glastonbury. And they invited me back to join the team that was going to Bhopal. So it was a mix of performance art and visual art, and I took a puppet that I'd made, a big puppet, because I thought the communication verbally is going to be really hard because I don't really have any Hindi. You know, I didn't know how much English people would have, especially the children that I'd be working with, and also wanting to have a way to communicate. And because the trip was for about 3 or 4 weeks, it was mainly with the view to creating some entertainment and time out and some fun for kids who don't really get a lot of that. With a longer project, with more time, one could go into more therapeutic space with the children. But so basically I used drawing techniques and puppetry with the children to communicate with them, and they were great. They really responded, and so did the adults as well, actually.
Fantastic, yeah, that's really good to hear. So are the effects of the disaster still quite widely felt?
In Old Bhopal, definitely. It's almost a city of two halves, I thought. In Old Bhopal, we were staying in a place called Sam Bhavna Clinic, which is only 400 metres from the factory site. And that you could see adults around whose mobility was affected, whose sight was affected. And there were plenty of children, well, the children being born now, today, with the effects because their parents were affected at the time, and now their children are being born with birth defect. Lots of facial problems, cleft palates, a lot of sight and hearing problems, mobility problems and learning difficulties. And we visited various clinics and schools and communities in the area.
And, you know, to me, art therapy seems a very... it's a way of getting over mental illness rather than physical illness. So there is still quite a bit of that mental scarring in people who live through it as well.
Absolutely, yeah. We had our guide was a young man called Sanjay, who was brilliant. At the time of the disaster, he and his family lived very close to the factory. And he was a baby at the time. And his older sister, who was 9 then, sort of rescued him out of the house. She woke up, all her family were choking, all the neighbours were in the same state when she tried to knock on doors to get help. She was choking, and she picked the baby up, wrapped him in a blanket and ran as far as she could away, managed to escape. And the two of them spent the next 10 years in an orphanage. And that night they lost their two parents and all of their other siblings except one older brother, who a few years later committed suicide. He just couldn't contend with the massive amount of loss, the sudden loss as well. So there is a lot of mental health problems. And also amongst women who now giving birth to babies with problems, they're finding life really difficult, not only because there's not the same kind of support systems there that you might hope to find here, but also the stigma attached to having a baby with problems. You know, it would be that maybe a husband might leave her. It might be that her sisters might find it hard to get married then, because people will see their family as not well with problems. So a lot of knock-on social and emotional effects, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, the work you've been doing is obviously very small part of the wider efforts that are going on in Bhopal. Have you been over there before?
No, it was my first trip.
There's no way of judging any gradual improvements.
Except by talking to the people who are already there. We've met a lot of people who've been working for a long time and who talk about the improvements that have been made. I think that there's so much to do and a small amount of resources to spread around a lot of people. And I think they found not very much support coming from the government or from Union Carbide, who owned the factory and have now sold it to Dow Chemicals. Mm. I think the people in those communities feel very much like hands have been washed of them, really. They don't feel very supported, and that it's all come from within the communities. And we did visit one community where we were setting up our workshops and sessions in a community hall that was basically like a sort of concrete garage in the middle of a swamp. They were living here, living in makeshift sort of shanty town, and putting stones and planks across the swamp to walk from place to place because the groundwater is contaminated, and when it rains the groundwater rises up and kids are playing in the puddles that contain the chemicals, and they're drinking that stuff from the boreholes as well. So it's not only babies being born because their parents have problems, but they're all getting ill throughout their lives from drinking the contaminated water.
Did you say the help from both the Indian government and Union Carbide is not really forthcoming, so it is now almost purely a charity effort.
Yes, I would say so, as far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name's Victoria Sutton. A lot of people know me as Tori.
Can you tell us about your recent trip to Bhopal in India? What's happening over there?
In 1984, when Union Carbide built a factory in Bhopal, there was a very large gas explosion and big poisonous gases went across the poorer part of India, poisoning the residents. Many of them died, women lost their children on that night, and the ones who survived, they're left with a catalogue of health complaints. Babies that are born now are born, they call them monstrous births, they're born with deformities. You know, the health catalogue in Bhopal is terrible and still continuing now, and nothing really has been done to resolve that.
Why hasn't anyone done anything?
Well, the company responsible, Union Carbide, was bought out by Dow, and they say that it's not their responsibility to do anything about this. Kind of these people have just been left on their own, basically, to suffer. They were poor to begin with, and now with all the health problems they're having, they're just, Dow have just stepped back and said, this is nothing to do with us.
What about the American government? Could they do something?
Well, Barack Obama was over in India recently, and Amnesty was saying that he should be addressing this. You know, this was the world's worst industrial disaster, that he should be addressing this while he was here, and that was avoided entirely while he made his trip to India. So even though it's an American company that are responsible for this, the American government are doing nothing to push them to take responsibility for what's happened.
Tell us what you saw when you were over there.
The clinic that's built, the Sabhavna Clinic, which has been built in Bhopal to help the victims of the gas, and this is a clinic that's been built by volunteers, victims of the gas disaster themselves, is a beautiful place. It's a place for healing, it's a place of compassion. It's got a very large herb garden, Western medicines to help the people with their health complaints. It's a very poor area that the clinic is in. There's a lot of poverty everywhere. And I took a trip to the actual plant itself, and it's just been left, I would say, as it was when they packed up and left back in the 80s. There are bottles and sacks of waste everywhere. Big lake of dirty water, which the locals often use to drink from because they run out of not exactly clean water, but water that's shipped in for them. I saw the waste from what they were creating that people used to build the floor in their homes. So I saw a lot of destruction, a lot of disease, but still of such a positive spirit amongst the people that live there. The people were just so beautiful. They were smiling and welcoming, even though they were going through these just absolutely terrible things. It was an amazing trip, and I highly recommend anyone to go. They're always welcome for people to spend time there, just visiting or helping in any way you can.
Now, the factory employed a lot of people, so what do people do now for money? Do they have jobs?
The people that were affected by the gas, a lot of them were unable to work due to the gas, respiratory problems, a lot of pain, women have menstrual problems, and a lot of them actually have psychological problems now, and they aren't recognised at all. Some of them got a very small amount of compensation given by the government, but one figure I read was $300 to $500. I mean, this isn't very much at all. Most of it has run out, so a lot of them are just begging on the streets. If they've got family to support them, they're lucky. If they don't, they're just in dire poverty.
Just remind me again, are there still children being born deformed in Bhopal after all this time?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I said children are born with webbed fingers. I've read reports of children born with three eyes, one eye, missing brains, cleft palates, one foot larger, the foot small, limbs on the wrong way. We know that these things happen in nature, and naturally there are things like this happening, but the percentage of these cases is enormous in Bhopal. And they've tested mothers' breast milk, and they found mercury and other very dangerous substances in their breast milk. It's in the groundwater. So yet babies are still being born.
What happens to babies? Are they just left to die because the families can't cope?
I don't know if they're left to die. A lot of them do die, I think, because their health problems are so terrible, and Sabhavna Clinic does its best to try to correct and to, I wouldn't say cure, but do their best to ease their pain and discomfort. I think the families look after them the best they can, but a lot of the families themselves are destitute, so I think a lot of them will die, definitely.
You're speaking tonight on behalf of Amnesty. What can Amnesty do in Bhopal?
Amnesty, when I had the 25-year anniversary, did do a lot to raise awareness about Bhopal and what happened there, because a lot of people have not heard of Bhopal. If you say, oh, Bhopal, they've no idea. I mean, it was the world's worst industrial disaster to date, I believe. So all we can do is keep raising awareness, keep writing postcards off to Dad, keep writing to the American government, keep raising awareness so that people can say, how can this happen? A company that promotes providing clean water for everyone on the planet says, no, I'm stepping back and not taking responsibility for this. So it's up to us to know and to act and to write and to protest and say, this isn't acceptable.
Are you putting pressure on the Indian government to do something?
People are writing to the Indian government as well. It's as much down to the Indian government to put pressure on America. But the problem is that governments often don't do what's necessarily right for the people because maybe they will miss out. I know when Obama went recently, I read that they sent an email saying if the Indian government keep mentioning Bhopal gas tragedy, it might have a chilling effect on investment in India. So I think the Indian government aren't necessarily pushing that hard, even though the people of India are horrified and appalled and shocked by what's happened there.
So if people listening want to find out more about Bhopal, say who don't know what happened, can they access information on your website?
Yes, I believe Amnesty do have part of their website. If you go onto the internet and just put Bhopal in the search engine, you will come up with the Bhopal organisation as well. And it tells you all about the Sabhavna clinic, about what happened on that night, the health effects, what's happening to the children, what's being done about it, demonstrations. So there's a huge amount of information on the internet. Just put Bhopal into your search engine and it will bring up the Bhopal organisation. That's probably the best way as well, because you can contact them, find out what you can do to help. People do things like bike rides and tea parties and things to try to raise money, because Sabhavna Clinic is supported by people's donations, doesn't accept it from companies, big organisations. It's purely supported by small people and their individual donations.
And how do you spell it?
B-H-O-B-A-L.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Malcolm Grieve reads another short story.
Cinnamon by Neil Gaiman. Cinnamon was a princess a long time ago in a small hot country where everything was very old. Her eyes were pearls, which gave her great beauty, but meant she was blind. Her world was the colour of pearls, pale white and pink and softly glowing. Cinnamon did not talk. Her father and mother, the Raja and Rani, offered a room in the palace, a field of stunted mango trees, a portrait of the Rani's aunt executed in hardwood and enamels, and a green parrot to any person who could get Cinnamon to talk. The mountains ringed the country on one side, the jungle on the other, and few and far came the people to try to teach Cinnamon to speak. But come they did, and they stayed in the room at the palace and cultivated the field of mango trees and fed the parrot, and admired the portrait of the Rani's aunt, who was quite a celebrated beauty in her day, though she was now old, crabbed and pinched with age and disappointment. And eventually they went away, frustrated and cursing the silent little girl. One day a tiger came to the palace. He was huge and fierce, a nightmare in black and orange, and he moved like a god through the world, which is how tigers move. The people were afraid. "There is nothing to be afraid of," said the Raja. "Very few tigers are man-eaters." "But I am," said the tiger. The people were much amazed at this, although it did nothing whatsoever to quell their fear. "You might be lying," said the Raja. "I might be," said the tiger, "but I'm not. Now, I am here to teach the girl cub to talk." The Raja consulted with the Rani, and despite the urgings of the Rani's aunt, who was of the opinion that the tiger should be driven out from the city with brooms and sharp sticks, the tiger was shown to the room in the palace, and given the enamel painting and the deeds to the mango field, and he would also have been given the parrot had it not squawked and flown to the rafters where it stayed and refused to come down. Cinnamon was shown into the tiger's room.
"There was a young lady from Riga," squawked the parrot from high in the rafters. "He went for a ride on a tiger. They came back from the ride with a lady inside and a smile on the face of the tiger."
Although, in the interests of historical and literary accuracy, I am obliged to point out here that the parrot actually quoted another poem, much older and a little longer, with ultimately a similar message. "There," said the Rani's aunt, "even the bird knows." "Leave me with the girl," said the tiger. And reluctantly the Raja and the Rani and the Rani's aunt and the palace staff left the beast with Cinnamon. She pushed her fingers into its fur and felt its hot breath on her face. The tiger put Cinnamon's hand into his. "Pain," said the tiger, and it extended one needle-sharp claw into Cinnamon's palm. It pierced her soft brown skin, and a bead of bright blood welled up. Cinnamon whimpered. "Fear," said the tiger, and it began to roar, starting so quietly you could scarcely hear it, working its way up to a purr, then a quiet roar like a distant volcano, then a roar so loud that the palace walls shook. Cinnamon trembled. "Love," said the tiger, and with its rough red tongue it licked the blood from Cinnamon's palm and licked her soft brown face. "Love?" whispered Cinnamon in a voice wild and dark from disuse. And the tiger opened its mouth and grinned like a hungry god, which is how tigers grin. It was a bright morning when the child and the tiger walked out of the room together. Cymbals crashed and bright birds sang, and Cinnamon and the tiger walked towards the Rani and the Raja, who sat at the end of the throne room, being fanned with palm fronds by elderly retainers. The Rani's aunt sat in a corner of the room, drinking tea disapprovingly.
"Can she talk yet?" asked the Rani.
"Why don't you ask her?" growled the tiger. "Can you talk?" the Raja asked Cinnamon. The girl nodded.
"Ha!" cackled the Rani's aunt. "She can no more talk than she can lick her own backbone."
"Hush!" said the Raja to the Rani's aunt.
"I can talk," said Cinnamon. "I think I always could."
"Then why didn't you?" asked her mother.
"She's not talking now," muttered the Rani's aunt, wagging one stick-like finger. "That tiger is throwing his voice."
"Can no one get that woman to stop talking?" asked the Raja of the room. "Easier to stop 'em than start 'em," said the tiger. And he dealt with the matter. And Cinnamon said,
"Why not?"
"Because I had nothing to say."
"And now?" asked her father.
"And now the tiger has told me of the jungle, of the chattering of the monkeys, and the spell of the dawn, and the taste of the moonlight, and the noise a lake full of flamingos makes when it takes to the air," she said. "And what I have to say is this. I am going with the tiger."
"You cannot do this thing," said the Raja. "I forbid it."
"It is difficult," said Cinnamon.
to forbid a tiger anything it wants. And the Raja and the Rani, after giving the matter a little consideration, agreed that this was so. And besides, said the Rani, she'll certainly be happier there. But what about the room in the palace, and the mango grove, and the parrot, and the picture of the Rani's late aunt? Asked the Raja, who felt that there was a place for practicality in the world. Give them to the people, said the tiger. And so an announcement was made to the people of the city that they were now the proud owners of a parrot, a portrait, and a mango grove, and that the Princess Cinnamon could speak, but would be leaving them for a while to further her education. A crowd gathered in the town square, and soon the door of the palace opened, and the tiger and the child came out. The tiger walked slowly through the crowd with the little girl on his back, holding tightly to his fur, and soon they both were swallowed by the jungle, which is how a tiger leaves. So in the end, nobody was eaten, save only for the Rani's elderly aunt, who was gradually replaced in the popular mind by the portrait of her, which hung in the town square, and was thus forever beautiful and young.
Thanks there to Malcolm Grieve. So we have Stephen Loft-Simpson with us, who is a specialist in sedan chairs. So for some of us who may not be quite as knowledgeable as your good self, would you explain what a sedan chair is to start off with?
Well, there are several definitions. I tend to use the tight definition, which is also known as a glass chair. When they were first thought of, they were just like armchairs with poles. They are really called carrying chairs, although if you look up the internet, you'll find carrying chairs labelled as sedan chairs. Then people built sides to them and they became canopied chairs, where you had a cover over the top in case it rained or for the sun. Then people added sides to them and they became enclosed chairs. Then someone in the City of London added glass windows and they were called sedans. They weren't called chairs, they were called sedans, and they could either be with a chair inside or as a litter. And this was at the time of just after the death of Shakespeare. The creation of the sedan and the chair, they only became joined in about 1708. So if you do a search on, for instance, the British Library newspapers, and you type in sedan chair and you wonder why there's nothing before 1708, it's because no one called them sedan chairs. But if you type in the word sedan, you go back, and the earliest mention, I think, is about 1643 in Paris.
So it's fair to say that your expertise has been acknowledged worldwide, because I understand you've contributed to a book recently.
Yes, I've been, I'm always being asked to produce things. One of the other reasons I started was because it seemed a little research subject, and I thought that my background, which was both in the motor industry, in design, that I could throw a different sort of angle and light to look at it. The other reason I got involved was, of course, I felt that I could actually achieve something more than anyone had achieved before, and that was partly to do with modern technology. With that, I felt I could change the number of errors, because the problem I came up with in the first 3 months I looked at the subject was that 25% of what people said disagreed. I mean, examples of that would be a chair would cross New Bond Street and it would change from a French chair to an Italian chair. Because as soon as you're trying to make a living from anything, you try and please your customer. And therefore, whatever you're selling is what your customer requires, rather than what it actually is. So those items get changed. And then the other aspect is dating them. Quite a challenge. But of course, I used my background in the motor industry to know that there were little changes going all the time. That sort of thing carries on and has been for years, and that's very similar with sedan chairs. And it was the fact that you needed to take digital pictures of the fine pieces of metalwork or carving or upholstery or fitments and compare them with sufficient other ones that you could prove beyond reasonable doubt that a chair came from this part of Europe rather than another part, and that it was roughly this age rather than that age, because what I had to do was find sufficient chairs, and I found now 1,025, whereas Loughborough University, a paper was written in the 1965, I think it was published, he'd found 55, and he'd measured them all. He'd come up with no result, really. They differed in size slightly. And I said, were you measuring the size of the person who had travelled in it, or the size of the door frame for which you had to carry it through? That wasn't going to tell you much. A bit like measuring a motor car won't actually tell you a great deal. It's the detail which matters. The interesting thing, though, is you see a chair, and I've seen one which was, for instance, on the Antiques Roadshow many years ago, and I looked at it and I said, well, it wasn't by the Royal Maker. It was by another renowned maker. It wasn't a beginner, because you could see the way it had been finished. It had also been cut down. But it took me 10 years to find another one, which turned out to be in a secondary school in East Sussex.
So of these 1,000 plus that you've managed to locate, have you bought any yourself?
I have ended up acquiring, well, I acquired one, and it was very interesting. I took it along to a local fete, and I took a Sinclair C5, which I also had a few of. Sinclair C5, 9 boys keen on it, 1 girl interested. You took along a sedan chair, it was reverse. There were 9 or 10 women, girls, and there was only 1 boy. And, of course, the relative one of the other gender was, in fact, the brother or sister of one of the others. Because I thought, well, I'll carry it up there, and then I soon realised it pulled my arms off. Then I thought, well, how do they actually carry them? And then I realised that they had leather straps. I then realised that the leather straps, the shape and the design of them, they differ around Europe. So I think I've only seen perhaps 10, a dozen leather straps. Poles are more common, but they're not always original poles. What I'm trying to do is to work out how many of these 1,025 sedan chairs, I've worked out which countries and where they come from, is to try and date or put a rough date on each. It's a little guesswork because it tends to be within the 5-15 year bracket. And I'm trying to date them for each decade to then find out and compare it to, for instance, newspaper adverts in the British Library newspaper collection. From comparing those, and producing a bar graph, you're very much coming up with the peak period is 1770 to 1790 for their use.
Thanks, Stephen. From sedan chairs to traction engines, we meet some enthusiasts up in the Lake District.
I'm here with the traction engine driver. Hello.
Hey, hi, how are you doing?
Fine. What's your name?
I'm Brian. Brian Wainwright.
So tell us all about traction engines.
Well, they're something from the oldest industrial revolution, and back in from the 1860s onwards, they were something that changed the way that people farmed and to begin with. So it was all about threshing and ploughing and then into haulage and obviously the fairgrounds as well. So they developed into multi-purpose machines.
How did they evolve, traction engines? Were they the first tractors?
Yes, they were. I mean, they started off as a boiler on wheels, so that it weren't even possible to move themselves. And then they would put a horse in the front and pull the engine along, put it to the next work, and that way. And then someone decided to put a chain around the back wheel and gears and made them self-propelled.
So why did they go out of fashion?
Cost. Diesel engines, especially after the First World War, there was an abundance of old World War One trucks, diesel engine, petrol engine trucks, and a lot of people started to use those because they were almost given away. They were very cheap to purchase. And if you can turn the key, why spend 2 hours getting up to steam pressure? So they now became less and less popular. And as they got worn out, they would get replaced by a diesel vehicle of some sort, whether it was on the farm, obviously with tractors, or in haulage as well, in heavy haulage and on the fairgrounds.
So do you know when the last traction engine was actually made, roughly?
The last ones will be in the 30s, because they did combine certain companies, were combined into a company called AE, I can't remember the acronym, so they got together to make the business last longer, but it didn't eventually work. So we're talking the late 30s. The last engines were really built in any volume.
So were they evolved from steam locomotives?
No, it's something quite different to a steam locomotive. The same boiler design. I mean, at the end of the day, the boiler in one of these is just like a locomotive boiler. So the design of that expanding to this.
Hello.
Kevin Lawrence, I'm the leader of the steam team here. And I've been involved with steam since I was a little one. The boilers on traction engines were following on the development of Stevenson's rocket, where the design in the boilers with multiple tubes in there to boil the water quicker. Like Brian was saying, it was on the road haulage, agricultural engines, different types, rollers for making your roads and everything. So they had different vehicles made. Unfortunately, you've missed the steam wagon, which is a Fordon. Probably heard of Fordons, but they started out with steam wagons. And then they also made some traction engines as well.
So we're looking through the window at a magnificent machine. It's called Bertha. Can you tell us how old this one is?
This was built in 1920 as a showman's engine and that. But going further on from this, there's a lot of traction engines in preservation. And there is a preservation movement, the National Traction Engine Trust. And a subsection of that trust is the Steam Apprentice Club, which Declan is one of the apprentices.
Declan, how old are you?
I'm only 15, so I'm only young.
It's nice to see young people getting interested in engineering. What do you like about this machine?
Well, everything about it, really. It just draws you in a way. I mean, it's just something to do. I mean, it's just different to what usually, you know. You've got to learn, you've got to pick up the talents, you've got to... It's that old trait you've got to relearn, and I'm still learning now. I keep getting things wrong, and it's always a learning curve, and it's what it is. It's just...
I think it's important to say as well, Declan's been doing it 4 years now, and Steam Apprentice Club, you can start at single figures as children of 7, 8, 9 years old, putting boiler suits on, steel toe cap boots, gloves and hats, and getting involved in full-size engines and learning all about them. So to get involved with something so big at such a young age, it makes them think about safety quite quickly, and they learn a lot. And
common sense and safety, and gives you confidence in what you're doing. You know, if you can steer that around, then you're all right. You're not crashed it, so it gives you a lot of confidence. It's confidence.
Are we the only country that made traction engines?
No. The Americans had a big business in traction engines as well, quite a lot over there. And there's some of the American ones actually in the UK. Some people have actually brought them over in preservation. They're quite cheap to buy because nobody wants them. They look very different. They have a very different design concept to what we did in terms of how they put all the gears and the crankshaft together. So they do look very different. But yeah, there's a lot of countries. Also Holland, Germany.
There's various people, but we were the biggest makers and exporters of, at the time, technology. Although it had been technology of the Industrial Revolution, we exported all over the world.
There's a preservation movement in Australia and New Zealand with a lot of English engines.
There's a lot still around, aren't there?
Yeah, there's probably over 1,000 in this country listed, I think, in the register. And you're probably 400 or 500 are actually available to steam at some point, at any time.
You described the apprenticeships. Is it becoming more popular for young people to actually get involved in things like this? Engines and steam and cleaning and...
I think it's more important because people are starting to realise that unless they get them involved now, they're never going to get them involved. And then what the older people have been looking after for generations, you know, even the preserved railways, they're finding now that it's harder and harder to get volunteers. So they've got to welcome the young kids in and give them a chance. And it was the preserve of the old guys with money and stuff. And we can't all afford these engines, but we need people to help out. You know, that you do need a crew to help you. One man cannot look after that engine easily.
Tried.
Yeah,
I tried 2 years ago. Many times I was on my own, and it is difficult to run the half size and the big engine and get the Ford and wagon out. You need a team, and without a team, it is difficult to do. But the local rally here, it's, the company steam gathering, on the Friday we have a steam apprentice day. And where the apprentices get a good opportunity to get the hands on, get mucky, enjoy the day, but in relative safety. And the chairman of the National Traction Engine Trust loaned me his engine for that weekend, and I thanked him for it, and especially for the use of his engine for the apprentice day, because I'm the Northwest coordinate for the Steam Apprentice Club. And one of my comments was, the youngsters and steam apprentices of today are the future of the preservation tomorrow, and getting them involved with engineering. There is a few in the Steam Apprentice Club who've now adults, young adults, they've taken engineering degrees, and they've gone into engineering, which is all good. It's what built this country. Yes, I am from an IT background, but basically I enjoy the engineering side of things.
There's nothing like cogs and wheels, is there?
No, you can see everything happening. You know what's going to go on. There's no electronics, no PCs to plug into these. There's no diagnostics. You've got to think about it and work it out for all the mechanical things. So it's
quite a taste, isn't it? It's a required taste.
Do you get attached to engines like Bertha?
Oh, yeah. That's why we keep coming here.
We visit a flour mill in Hilly, North Devon, an area of outstanding natural beauty.
Right, okay, so in this room there's a large number of machines. They all spell a different aspect of the demise of traditional mills. Let's take you back to the end of the 1700s, early 1800s, when the Industrial Revolution was underway. You'd started to get a lot more machinery that had been developed. So, for instance, if you see on the back wall, there is a scythe with some of our Marriswigian wheat, and you can see the length of the straw involved. Now, that... a man could fell an acre of field in a day if he was good at his job. Now, a horse drawing one of these newfangled reaping machines could do 10 acres in a day. That puts an awful lot of people out of work when it's an arable economy. As you saw from the Olympics and that really dramatic start, they showed how it changed to the Industrial Revolution. It was very profound at the time, a lot more, I would say, than our present technological revolution, if you like, because at that time it put almost 60% of workers out of a job in places like Norfolk. And so you had burnings of all these new modern machines, and you see maps and it says such and such was burnt on such a night. And there was a lot of crime in that respect because people could just see all their jobs going. Mm-hmm. We're concerned that 10%, so 60% is just unheard of, really. There is a lovely letter there that was in the Ilfracombe Journal in 1855, And this was of a gentleman who's a George Thomas, a salter and miller of this parish, who had gone to New Zealand to start a new life. And he was saying what a wonderful thing it was to his friend. You must bring your blacksmithy tools and your family. You can't help but make a fortune here and provide for your family. Wonderful opportunity, and on and on and on. So that great big long letter. But when we wrote to the libraries down there and said, have you got any reference as to whether it had a successful mill or not? They said, he didn't exist. We have no reference on any of the ships that came in, on any of the records of the time. And they thought it was just propaganda by the British government to get people to emigrate. And you had this for America, you had it for Canada, and this is for New Zealand. Very subtle, because it's for the last sort of 150 years, no one's really realised. You know, we were being persuaded to move abroad. Right, okay, so after you have, like, the steam engine comes along. So now you've got a power plant that's no longer horse-drawn, no longer water-powered or wind-powered, and you can put it anywhere in the country, so long as you can get fuel to it. This meant that you could now put mills, big industrial mills, using the new technology of roller milling, where you actually crush the grain rather than you actually tear it apart. So crushing the grain means that there's very little wear and tear, apart from on the bearing. So if you keep everything lubricated, these things run all day and all night. You bring in massive ironclad ships from the States or Canada from their massive wheat fields, and they can sell a lot cheaper. We've abolished the corn laws, so now you can buy at any price. The corn laws were put in place for the Napoleonic Wars, so that we kept the price high, so the farmers got really rich, so did the church, because they had a tithe on the farms. Then you got poor as a church mouse, because they ran out of all their money, because they weren't getting anything from the farmers. Everyone was moving into the city, needed a lot more food, so, and on it goes. So the politics of the time and the technology of the time changed the whole landscape. But you see, we still had a really poor road structure. So if you can bring in a massive ship from abroad, you can turn it into flour in the harbour, straight back onto barges, straight into the cities on their main waterways. You've now been able to feed this ever-expanding population without even referring to the fields of Britain. So they deteriorated, and then you get the holiday resorts starting to appear in the countryside. The countryside started to become a place of leisure, so places like Ilfracombe started to appear, and Blackpool. And with the steam engines, you can now have the railways, so now you could transport large volumes of people out to the countryside. So there's a lot. It was all linked together. The only thing that really kept these type of mills going was the World Wars, funnily enough, because you had fuel shortages, didn't have a lot of manpower, and if you could mill locally and you had your stones were still in working order, you ran them till they bust, basically. So by the end of the Second World War, when all the ports were back up to working again, they weren't being bombed, we weren't sending all our food abroad, you've got much more of a production going on in the country, and that therefore meant that the mills, they were totally unusable. The infrastructure for supporting them was no longer there. You couldn't buy new stones because they were no longer being made. That's why on the pictures in the other room, you can see stones in the Derbyshire and Yorkshire, all just scattered around the hillsides. And in fact, Derbyshire has as its emblem the millstone, because there are just so many in the countryside. And they really didn't see it coming, because when these roller mills were first put in, first year, there were three of them. Second year, about 15. Third year, 50 to 100 mills. It was a massive expansion once they got the technology right. And that gives you most of the backdrop as to how things developed in milling and why most of these places turned into holiday cottages. And just a few of these have been saved for the nation to show people how it used to be done.
First, they hurled poor Albert up on a V2's converted spire. Reaching for the jealous god, he'd lost the Jews to fire. Leica curved across the earth in her metal carapace, until all batteries failed, she howled alone in space. The Yanks then launched Gordo, who became a monkey ghost when the leaky capsule sank far from his forest coast. Ham the ape touched heaven's face. On landing,
nearly drowned, recovered, he ate oranges on the warship's yawing ground. In the Russian Bayon, tortoises, rats and fungi, rhesus monkeys, newts and fruit flies flew as high. France preferred projecting cats. Felix soared from Guiana. Nassau tried out insects, frogs, microbes, and other fauna. In the wreckage of Columbia, they found C. elegans in several generations, alive in a metal box. No trace of the astronauts, but the weightless worms, uniquely evolved in forms, deciphered the human genome. After the O-rings, after the fires, walking in space and on the moon, after Yuri and Buzz, and all that fuss, consider those who died too soon.
Tim Burrows has brought his sitar in following his trip to India. He's now going to give us a flavour of this exotic continent. Thanks, Tim.
That's all from Backchat this week. The studio engineer was Adrian Petrovsky and the producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, James Melia.
And goodbye from me, Poppy Searchfield.
So until next week, goodbye.